This is the AIV podcast from the University of Warwick. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Brazzo. This podcast explores the ongoing work of scholars who are part of the ERC-funded Aristotle in the Vernacular project. Support for this podcast is provided by the European Research Council and the University of Warwick. Technical support is provided by the Transnational Resources Center at the University of Warwick. In the popular imagination, the Italian Renaissance conjures up a time of sumptuous artistic masterpieces, breathtaking paintings with brilliant colors and one-point vanishing perspective, magnificent, lifelike sculptures whose bodies boldly declaim the beauty of the human form, and architectural wonders, both daring in their scope and triumphant in the elegance of their design. But the Renaissance was about much more than beautiful art. In fact, many of these artists took their subject matter from classical mythology, poetry, and philosophy. None of this would have been possible if not for Italy's role at the forefront of classical reception, when Latin and Greek texts from the ancient world were taken up again after years of neglect. Reception history is not only interesting from the point of view of intellectual historians who study the history of ideas, it's also crucial for understanding much of the genesis of our modern world. One of the golden threads in this rich and complex tapestry is the reception of the Greek philosopher Aristotle. Dante referred to him in the Divine Comedy as the Maestro di coloro che sanno, master of those that know. It was in opposition to Aristotle's physics that Galileo Galilei developed his theories of motion, which would go on to inspire both Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein. The reception of Aristotle's poetics was crucial to the development of literary theory in Europe from 1550 to the early 19th century, while Aristotle's Ethics was the standard textbook for moral philosophy taught in the universities. Yet, despite Aristotle's cultural importance in the Renaissance and his far-reaching impact on modern Western culture, we know very little about how early modern thinkers first received his works and how these individuals shaped the reception of his texts. What were the interests and agendas of these translators, commentators, and interpreters, and how did they domesticate Aristotle for their various audiences? A new project funded by the European Research Council at the University of Warwick and at the University of Ca' Foscari in Venice has set out to answer these questions, aiming to provide the first comprehensive analysis of works written on Aristotle in Italian between 1400 and 1650. During this time, over 250 works were written on Aristotle, such as commentaries, translations, compendia, dialogues, and more, that aim to make the systematic thinker accessible to contemporary audiences. The project is directed by Professor Marco Scarbi in Venice, while the Warwick team is led by Professor Simon Gilson and Dr. David Lines, who I have in studio with me today. Welcome, Dr. Lines.
Hello.
Can you tell us a little bit about the project?
Well, the project aims to give an analysis of all kinds of works that were produced on Aristotle in the Renaissance, but not in Latin, as has traditionally been done, but works written in the vernacular. And in this case, we're looking at works written in Italian.
And why focus specifically on Italy as opposed to somewhere like Spain, France, or another European country?
Well, one of the problems is that the production in countries such as France and Spain, and especially other countries such as Germany and England, is actually rather small for vernacular works. Latin continues to be very strong in those contexts, although Spain is the place that has the second highest number of vernacular translations and commentaries probably in Europe. Italy is actually at the forefront in terms of the size of the production and the rank and the quality of the people involved.
And what are the reasons for that?
Lots of different reasons, especially connected to how the Italian language evolves during the 15th and the 16th centuries. So in the 15th century, and I'm being a little bit broad and generalizing here, but you could say that most of the production, which is around the classical authors, including the philosophical authors, Aristotle and Plato, for instance, is done in Latin. Humanists are very keen to see works written in eloquent Latin, the language of the Roman people, whereas Italian has a status which is quite inferior to Latin at this point. When the 16th century comes along, by 1525, 1530, with the work of Pietro Bembo and his work on the Italian language, the vernacular comes up in status, and people feel much freer to write in the vernacular, not just philosophical works, of course, but poems and all kinds of other literary works, including works like Machiavelli's Principe, of course. And these lead to a new wave of translations and commentaries in Italian.
One question that some of our listeners might have is why the particular focus on Aristotle? In my brief forays into Renaissance philosophy, I thought that Platonism was always a very important and dominant discourse throughout Renaissance philosophy. So why the focus on Aristotle in this project?
Well, I think what we need to consider is that Aristotelianism during the period still continues to be an extremely important current. And that's true not just for the universities and the schools of religious orders, production in Latin, and so forth, but all across Europe up to around 1650. So the studies of Charles Schmidt and other scholars from about the 1980s and even before up to the present day have shown that Platonism was an important current, for sure. Marsilio Ficino, whom some listeners may be familiar with, in the 1480s provided the first comprehensive Latin translation of Plato's works since antiquity. But Aristotelianism continues to dominate the discourse of philosophy. And there's a very good reason for that. The reason is that Aristotle is much more teachable than Plato is. The Platonic dialogues are great fun, as you'd doubtless know, and they explore very important questions, but it's very hard to communicate those in a classroom or to somehow organize the philosophy of Plato systematically. Aristotle is a lot easier to do that with because of the intrinsic organization of the works themselves. So he leads you from notions of logic up through natural philosophy, moral philosophy, metaphysics, in a very clear kind of way, examining specific questions, building on those questions in interesting ways. And the tradition of commenting on Aristotle actually doesn't stop at all during the Renaissance. It continues and is possibly much more productive, in fact, than during the previous millennium.
And might the ease with which scholars taught Aristotle in the universities have something to do with this idea that Aristotle's works were course notes from his lectures?
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That's one of the problems, actually, with Aristotle's reception for some people in the period, is they note that there's some internal contradictions, and they're trying in various ways to solve these contradictions. And they're also, at the same time, trying to argue that Aristotle is a very eloquent philosopher. It's not really true if you look at the Greek nowadays to consider him from that perspective, because it's the students writing the notes. But nonetheless, they're trying to argue that, of course, if he was a great philosopher, he must have written beautifully as well. So that's a concern that ties in with the issues of humanism and how they tried to make people aware of the eloquence of ancient authors.
You mentioned translations and commentaries. What other kind of texts are you studying on this project, and what led to the selection of these kinds of texts?
Other texts that we're looking at include compendia, so those are epitomes or reduced condensations, shall we say, of the specific works. They could be works that give sentences of the various philosophers. They could be dialogues. There are lots of those, especially in the 16th century, in which people mount a conversation, just like ours, and discuss important issues. Or you have treatises, of course. So there's a huge variety in terms of the number of genres, and we're still actually looking to explore some of those. And what they've come out of is a huge census of the materials that was undertaken between 2010 and 2014, looking at the various aspects of the production of Aristotelianism in the Italian Renaissance.
Now, you mentioned a census of these materials. That was part of the previous Aristotle project that was here at Warwick.
That's
Can you
right.
tell us a little bit about that project and how this new project is different?
So that project was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council in the UK. And it had two main aims. One was to provide an overview of all the production, both manuscript and in print, on vernacular Aristotelianism in Italy between 1400 and 1650. And we achieved that through a database, which is now available for free online. But a second very important aim was that of starting to analyze several of these works, which we did successfully in partnership also with scholars at the Warburg Institute in London and at the University of the Piemonte Orientale in Vercelli in Italy. So Luca Bianchi in Italy and Joe Cray at the Warburg Institute were both involved in our project as well.
And how is the new project different from what the previous project was doing? What new focuses does it have?
The second project, the present project, builds on both the census and the analyses provided in the first project by delving in further depth on specific areas of the philosophical tradition. So as our listeners probably know, Aristotle wrote on nearly everything that was known in his time. So his production includes logic, moral philosophy, that means ethics and politics mainly, natural philosophy, which includes things like meteorology, physics, and psychology. It includes metaphysics, it includes rhetoric, it includes poetics. So he was, in fact, the latter point of view, he was one of the most important theorizers of what constitutes, for instance, tragedy and things of that sort. So these are aspects that we're trying to drill into in further depth than we were able to do in the previous project. The team in Venice is looking specifically at two aspects. One has to do with paratexts of the various works, so everything that surrounds the texts, shall we say, prefaces, marginalia, which are printed, epistolary dedications, and things of that sort. But they also have a focus on natural philosophy and on logic, let's say the strongly philosophical dimension anyway.
What specifically is the team at Warwick focusing on? What distinguishes the work of the team at Warwick from the team in Venice?
I suppose you could say that what we're mainly interested is in moral philosophy and its links to psychology. On the one hand, one of our research fellows is examining the links between animals and humans and as concerns the soul. I'm examining ethics and politics, and those two concerns, of course, go very well together.
Mm-hmm. And my own work is also bridging that as well by looking at the intersections between poetics and politics.
Absolutely. And there's no way you can really cut the cloth very neatly. So the whole other segment of the research team at Warwick dealing with rhetoric and poetics is obviously also at the same time dealing with how moral character is dealt with and expressed in the human being, what kinds of forces actually encourage people to become better human beings or to speak more eloquently. As we know, that's a concern of humanism as well.
Your scholarship concerns the teachings of Aristotle's ethics in Italian universities during this period. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how that's reflected in this current project?
Yes, well, one of the very interesting points is that this vernacular tradition doesn't just come out of nothing. It actually relies on a earlier tradition, both in Latin and in Greek, of interpreting Aristotle. So the Aristotle that we know about in the universities was, of course, studied in Latin, usually on the basis of Latin texts, although sometimes there were Greek originals that were involved as well. So it's very hard to dissociate the two. One of the people whom I've studied in detail recently is a man called Bernardo Segni, who was active in Florence and the Accademia Fiorentina in the 1540s and 1550s. Now, this was an academy which brought together people who were not necessarily involved in the university, although they could be, and it was also directed often to the general public. So they had two meetings per week, one for the members of the academy and one for anyone who wanted to join in.
So kind of like an open university in a sense.
Yes, quite. And no one had to pay fees, which was quite nice. And so Segni wrote in connection with his position and activities in the academy, he wrote a number of works on the ethics and the politics and the rhetoric and the poetics. And these are all written in Italian, translating the text and commenting on it. So one can really look at these texts and also look at the production in the universities and see deep interconnections, which are quite fascinating.
It sounds like the methodology, at least in your work on Segni and possibly in the project at large, is informed somewhat by translation studies. Are there any other methodological approaches that inform the project's current work?
Well, one of those would be the whole theory of classical reception and how that has evolved over time. But I think one of the distinctive aspects of this project is that classical reception studies have typically focused on the Latin or the Greek transmission of texts from antiquity. What we're trying to do is look at the vernacular production in relationship to that Greek and Latin production as well. I suppose another very important point is that in thinking about intellectual history and its methodology and approaches, we don't just want to focus on a text for whatever merit, philosophically and otherwise, a text may have, but also look at how that text came about, the context it took place in, the public it addressed, why certain printers decided to print it, who read it and why, what effects these texts may have had on the larger society and its culture during their time and also later on.
What kind of audiences were reading Aristotle in early modern Europe?
Well, lots and varied, I think, is the short answer. You have professional audiences reading Aristotle. Those are people who comment on texts, philosophy from antiquity, both in the universities and in the religious orders. So religious orders have their own schools. That's important. But you also have a wide range of people not connected to these professional groups, let's say, who are reading Aristotle, both in Latin and in the vernacular. So you can imagine that a good proportion of the population who have gone to schools, what we would call grammar schools today, where they taught Latin, would be able to understand the works written in Latin. But not all of those works were necessarily designed for people without a specific preparation in the technical vocabulary of philosophy. So sometimes in the Latin tradition, you had other works being written that were somehow addressed to a broader public, that were therefore more elegant, less technical, and could be of appeal to someone who didn't necessarily have a lot of time to engage in the technicalities of the discourse. At the same time, you have another whole group of people who are reading these texts in Italian or in Spanish or in French also, of course. And these people tend to be people who have not necessarily had a formal education in Latin, or people who have had a formal education in Latin but find it easier to read in the vernacular. And so some of these people can actually have quite high positions. They might be leaders of armies or captains, or they might be the retainers of particular rulers, or they might come from a completely different kind of social group. They might be, for instance, merchants, or they might be quite lowly in some other ways. But they have obviously a high interest in accessing the works of this very, very important philosopher from antiquity, and understanding how this philosopher can make their life better in all kinds of ways.
Were these audiences primarily men? Were any women reading Aristotle in the period?
Yes, women were reading as well, but probably not as nearly as often as the men were. We do have a very few works that were addressed specifically to women, at least that's what we read in the dedications to these works. But the evidence is something that we have to sift through in order to understand that phenomenon much more clearly. But there certainly is a sense in which some of these works are explicitly addressed to a female audience. One of the works I've looked at recently is written by Francesco Piccolomini, who was a professor of philosophy at the University of Padua. When he went into retirement and returned to his hometown, to Siena, he wrote various works, one of which was a summary of his much longer Latin treatise, the Comprehensive Treatise of Morals. And he wrote this work in Italian, dedicated it to the consort of the Duke of Tuscany at the time. And this work is really very remarkable because he brings her into the conversation immediately in the prologue and at the end. But we don't have any evidence that she actually ever read it. And in fact, most of the time, as you read through the text, you see that he offers a lot of examples of from contemporary history. And he sings the praises of the dukes, of course. But he never mentions her specifically. So it's very hard to get at this phenomenon of female readership from these specific works. Maybe someone listening to us will do further research on this, and maybe they'll look at marginalia and other signs of reading that we find in copies of these books, which we know belonged to some women as well.
Moving from Piccolomini's audience to our contemporary audience, who are the audiences you're envisaging for this project, and what kind of outputs are you thinking of?
Well, we have an interest, obviously, in attracting scholarly academic audiences, but in also making the results accessible to other people. We have an exhibition, for instance, which is planned for April and May of 2016 in Venice at the Museo Correr, and this will be entitled Venice and Aristotle in the period around 1450 to around 1600. And we're hoping that visitors to Venice will come and see how Venice acted as a center of production of these works, both in Greek and Latin, but also in the vernacular.
So getting tourists to think of Venice as more than just gondolas and canals, in a sense.
Yes, quite. Of course, that's a part of the romantic appeal of Venice. But it was also a huge center of printing, and printing of vernacular works, as well as the better-known production of Greek and Latin works. Some listeners may be familiar with Aldus Minucius and his great press in the late 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. But this wasn't just producing great Greek and Latin classics for an elevated audience who could afford the very expensive books that this press produced. It was Venice was also the center of other publishers and printers who really liked to communicate these results much more broadly.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. In the works that you're studying, are they primarily printed works? Are they primarily manuscripts? And what's the difference between commentaries and these other genres of thinking about Aristotle in the vernacular between the manuscript tradition and the printed tradition?
Right, that's a very complex question. Let me address, first of all, the issue of manuscripts versus printed works. We found about 300 manuscripts and about 250 printed works in very numerous editions, which reflect this flowering of vernacular Aristotelianism. So what's remarkable, first of all, is that the manuscript tradition goes on way beyond the invention of print in the 1450s to reach up to the late 17th century and beyond. So that's a very important point that we've found. And we've also found that a lot of different printers are engaged in the activity of printing Aristotelian works. So what we want to find out, among other things, is why one particular printer, say Bartolomeo dell'Imperatore in Venice, is particularly interested in publishing numerous editions of Aristotle in the vernacular, and also how particular authors associated with particular publishing houses. So you'll see that Bernardo Segni in Florence, for instance, gets many of his works published by Lorenzo Torrentino, who is the main printer for the Academy in Florence. And you'll see that in Venice, various other printers want to take these works in the vernacular and print them for a broad public. I assume that they wanted to sell. They wanted to make money. And so the question is how you do that quickly and effectively to reach a broad audience.
Was there any evidence that once printing really became very popular and very widespread, that the manuscript tradition continued, or is there a neat line at which point the manuscript seemed to drop off?
No, you can't really see that distinction neatly at all. In fact, reaching into the 17th century, you find our one specific and only work on the metaphysics that survives, really, is in manuscript form. This is beginning of the 17th century, so quite late in the arc of the works that we're exploring. So that's very interesting to see how that relationship continues to work over time.
That's quite fascinating. And are there any other public readings of Aristotle or public commentaries on Aristotle that aren't just the universities and the academies, or are those the two main sites where that's occurring?
Those would be the two main sites. And so looking at institutional contexts, those are the ones that you have to look at. We are very interested in finding out whether there are other possibilities as well. And so if our listeners know of any of those, I hope that they'll get in touch with us. The issue of genres that you mentioned previously is something that we're interested in exploring further. We don't really know at the moment exactly how we can map the development of genres onto the timeline. And so whether there was a specific period, for instance, in which dialogues were more important, and then they fell off for some reason at a later point, and how those various cultural phenomena work. So that's something that we hope one of our research fellows will be looking into as well.
Finally, what would you say is the value of studying works like this? Some of these works are over 500 years old. Most of them are, in fact. And what value does this bring to our contemporary world?
That's a very interesting question, because that brings us back into what historical inquiry is for. So you're right, that's exactly the question one of my sons would ask me, why should we bother? And I like to think that these texts help us think about how, in the past, works have been transmitted by different kinds of groups and by different kinds of individuals and brought to the attention of broader segments of society. In a sense, that's something that we're engaged in doing today as well, both in the universities and in our work outside of the universities, trying to make people who are intelligent and well-informed on so many different things, but maybe not on these other specific issues, aware of how valuable texts from a very remote time could be, and how people thought in fundamentally different ways, I suppose, about certain issues. I think from the time of Descartes onwards, one of the ways in which people have done philosophy fundamentally has been that of coming up with their own solutions to particular problems, rather than seeing philosophy as a way of commenting on what previous thinkers have written. And this is maybe the big difference between 15th, 16th century works and the works from the 17th century to the present. So that's what we're trying to investigate. This whole activity of commenting on Aristotle, or commenting sometimes on other authors, why is that valuable? Is that a model that we can think about also today? Should our philosophy even today be informed more strongly by historical perspectives?
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. That was very helpful.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Lines, one of the leaders of the Aristotle in the Vernacular Project here at Warwick. You can learn more about the project and the work of its various members by visiting the Aristotle in the Vernacular Project webpage at tiny.cc/ERC Aristotle. That's tiny.cc/ERC Aristotle. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes or via the audio video page on the project website. Music from today's podcast was provided by Cave One and Broke for Free under Creative Commons licenses. More of their music is available on SoundCloud and Bandcamp. Support for this podcast was provided by the European Research Council and the University of Warwick.